Bandwidth for the Tech Guy on KFI Podcast is brought to you by DSL Extreme at DSLExtreme.com. Hi, this is Leo, and this is my KFI Podcast. This show originally aired on Saturday, May 27th, 2006, on KFI AM 640 in Los Angeles. Hi, this is Leo, and this is my KFI Podcast. This show originally aired on Saturday, May 27th, 2006, on KFI AM 640 in Los Angeles.
May 27th, 2006.
KFI is the talk station that does live local news on the hour, on the half, and when it breaks. At 11:06, I'm Deborah Mark, KFI News.
It's Saturday morning, and I am Leo Laporte, the tech guy on KFI AM 640. More stimulating talk radio today and tomorrow from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. We talk high tech with you. I mean, and high tech means everything from digital cameras to cell phones to home theater. And oh yeah, I guess you could do computers and the internet too. Absolutely. All the subjects. We have a webpage associated with the show. If you want to know more about the things we talk about, that's available through KFIAM640.com. If you hover your mouse over the show's menu item, you'll see a drop-down menu with my name on it, Leo Laporte, down there, kind of in the middle. Click that. That'll take you to my page. Right under my picture, the official website is the show notes website, leo.am. If you just want to type it in, leo.am. And this is a Saturday show 249 for May 27th, 2006. As usual on Saturday, I'd like to start by talking a little bit about the news. The biggest story, I thought, anyway, one of the most interesting. Nike has announced it's going to do a deal with Apple to make iPod shoes. iPod shoes. Actually, it's more, apparently, a even larger kind of deal. Including not just Nike, Nike shoes, but talking about shirts and so forth. But the shoes I thought were the most interesting. They have a little pouch for a transceiver unit that will go in the shoe. It has a little accelerometer in it and some other measurement stuff, and it can keep an eye on what your running speed is, how far you've traveled, how many strides. I don't think it does your heart rate, but it does keep track of your run. And then you add this little unit to your Nano. It's designed for the Nano. I think, it might work on other iPods, but runners love the Nano. So I think the Nano is specifically what they're designing it for. And then the Nano records the distance run and so forth, and even will upload it to a website. Now, it's not available yet, but I just think it's one of the wackiest kind of combinations I've seen yet. I mean, why not jump on the iPod bandwagon if you're Nike? So you have to have the Nike shoes. You put the sensor underneath. If you lift up the liner, there's a sensor you put underneath the liner in your left foot, and that you attach the receiver to your iPod Nano, and then you run, and it tells you all sorts of interesting information, like how many miles, your pace. Right on the iPod, which is wild. And I have a feeling that they're also doing a kind of some sort of connection with the music, because they say hear real time feedback. I don't know if that's a click, click, click or what. And then also, if you have your song that is for your kick, your end of your run, they have a special button. Obviously, they talk to a lot of runners. What would you like? And then you upload and you press the button, and it plays your kick song, right? And then on Nike's going to have special workout mixes and stuff. It actually makes me think that I ought to do a health podcast for this, but I'm sure Nike will be doing this. What an interesting idea. And then you can upload all this data to a Nike website. And they've had GPS watches that do this before. I don't think there's GPS in it, and I don't think it measures heart rate. So it may not be as functional, frankly, as some of the existing watches. just shows you another way that Nike can, you know, you get, if you have a successful consumer product, everybody beats a path to your door. You betcha. Speaking of successful consumer products, Nintendo has announced that the Wii, the game machine I love to say the name of, the Wii, it's starting to sound like a piglet. I mean to say Wii, not Wii. The Wii, which is the next generation video game console from Nintendo, and has surprisingly put Nintendo back in the front of the race. They were lagging behind for so long. They've announced it will not be more than $250 in the U.S. Should come out in time for Christmas. When you compare it to the expensive Xbox 360 or even the more expensive PlayStation 3. No rumor that PlayStation and Sony's going to start spelling the 3 in PlayStation 3, T-H-R-I-I. 3! The PlayStation 3, which is going to be, I think, $600. So, wow. Wow. You can get a $500 version if you're willing to strip it down. Xbox is not a whole lot more expensive, but most people are going to get the $400 version. So $250 is very attractive, especially when you're aiming at kids. And I think the Nintendos do tend to aim at the kid market. Although, I have to be very careful. I said that about the Nintendo DS, and I got lots of mail from people who said, no, no, the Nintendo DS. And by the way, the new DS Lite is the hottest item. Not quite out yet, but any day now, and it's going to be the hottest item of the summer. They're shipping it right when school gets out. Interesting timing. And so Nintendo back, man. They are back. They are hot. They're kind of the top company right now. With the Wii! Microsoft has announced that they're going to start shipping the next generation of Vista. They're getting very close now to the release version of Vista, Beta 2, and a beta of Microsoft Office to go along with it. Although I have to say, there have been a number of complaints from the Vista beta testers, or as I like to call them, the Vista beta testers, saying this is not ready for prime time. The key on getting somebody to really test your software, your operating system, is to make it usable. If you can't use it in day-to-day work, you can't really tell Microsoft where the bugs are. And apparently they're saying, no, it's not that reliable yet. I can't use it day to day. So beta 2 of Vista coming out probably next week. Maybe, no, I guess it already came out. I didn't download it. I'm sorry. I'm just looking now. It's out. I have to get it. And then next week, no, it's out as well. They have already died. I'm a little behind. I'm looking at the news now, and I see it's out. I had an older story. So Beta 2 is out for Office 2007 and Vista. They call this the CTP. The Community Test Program, something like that. Give you all a chance to take a look at it. So we're getting close to the next version of Windows. People are not going crazy over its reliability. Speaking of Word, I don't know if you follow the security bulletins. Monday, a major security advisory on Word, what they call a zero-day vulnerability. In other words, at the same time as the vulnerability was announced, within a 24-hour period, hackers had already released attacks based on that vulnerability. The attack comes from downloading or opening a Word file, which it gives the hacker complete access to your system. It's a serious security flaw. Microsoft has often offered some workarounds, things that you can do, not fixes, but things that you can do to protect yourself. Mainly not open Word attachments from strangers. However, they have not offered a patch yet. Interesting, though, because a patch is available. And once again, this has happened before, where a researcher comes along, a security researcher, and says, if Microsoft won't fix it, we will. Now, I haven't used it, and I don't know, Matthew Murray, the guy who posted the script, it's a simple registry mod, so it's probably safe. But I'm not vouching for it. But essentially, his registry mod changes the software restriction policies. And so it gives people the ability to launch Word, but not gives, and it presents Word from making the modifications to the system that would be required for the exploit. Part of the problem is that you have to be running under an administrator account. We see this all the time with Windows security flaws, that actually security flaws on all systems, that if you're not running as a root or super user or as an administrator, the flaw doesn't work. And this is a case where, unfortunately, Windows, because it's so hard to use Windows as a limited user, most people run as administrator, this is where it's going to bite you. So if you're in a corporation, I'm sure they have you running as a limited user. If you're at home, you should consider it. And you know, there'll be some areas where programs will be in, you know, for instance, you can't update your antivirus. So you have to log in as an administrative user to do that. You can't install software. Those things are tolerable. The bigger issue is some programs just won't work. But often you can right-click on the program's icon and select Run As and run it as an administrator, and that will fix the problem. And boy, now's the time to do that. Now's the time to do that. This is a big Windows, actually Word flaw, Microsoft Word flaw. Does not affect Mac users. It's a Windows, Word in Windows. We're going to take a break, come back, take some calls. I am Leo Laporte, the tech guy on KFI, AM 640, more stimulating talk radio.
The KFI News team works weekends. KFI News, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
Leo Laporte, the tech guy, KFI, AM 640, more stimulating talk radio. All right. Well, you've heard my take on net neutrality. I mean, I think there's a lot to be said about it. I just want to bring it to your attention. We talked about it last week, and I thought it would be worth spending some more time. Let's go to Canada, British Columbia. Carl is on the line and also wants to talk a little bit about net neutrality. Hello, Carl. Welcome to KFI.
Hi, Leo. It's XD99 in the chat room.
Oh, well, we've talked before, haven't we? And you're a great contributor to our chat room, so thank you for joining me. Hey, Carl.
Hey, and I think the issue of net neutrality is important because in Canada, Shaw, that provides cable internet access,
mm-hmm.
charges a quality of service feature for anyone that decides to go with a third-party internet telephony VoIP service like Vonage.
Sure, that's how they make their money back, isn't it? You know, because now, does Shaw offer their own voice over internet service?
Yes, they do. And if you go with their own, you don't get charged the $10.
Aha.
Extra.
Now, they're allowed to do that by Canadian law. You cannot do it in the U.S. yet. And that's why companies like Verizon and SBC, who are both telephone providers and internet providers, and Comcast, who wants to be in that business, and Time Warner, who wants to be in that business, that's why they're all lobbying for this right to do this. So there's you know what, Carl, that's a really good example. Here's a company who is, it's blatant. They're saying, well, if you're not going to use our service, we're going to charge you $10 more.
That's,
and their rationale is you're using our data for your phone calls. You should pay more. And how would you argue against that, Carl? I mean, why shouldn't you pay more? Because,
well,
you
the
know,
package is optional.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to get, if you don't want the quality of service, but then Shaw also filters out BitTorrent traffic as well to try and keep the traffic numbers down.
Oh, see.
So that's also why I don't use them as an ISP. I prefer TELUS.
Yeah.
Because they don't do any of that filtering.
They don't do that. And see, I think the one legitimate comeback is, well, let the market decide. If you don't, you know, you at least have a choice, though, and that's the issue. And I think a lot of people don't have a choice. But as we were talking about, I mean, if some do it and some don't, it's doomed. The only way this can work is if everybody, all these companies collude illegally, by the way. They're not allowed to do this, but they illegally collude to say, we're all going to charge, if they want to use voice over internet, we're going to charge them how much? $10. $10 more a month. If they're going to use BitTorrent, how much are we going to charge them? $10 more a month. They have to collude to do that. They have to price fix to do that. That's illegal in the United States. And that's the only way it'll succeed. Otherwise, as in Canada, if Shaw doesn't and TELUS doesn't, people will just go to TELUS. Now, there is the issue of people who aren't sophisticated enough or don't have the choice. Those people are screwed. I think this really should be against the law, frankly. I think that bits are bits. It doesn't cost them. Understand something. It doesn't cost Shaw a penny more for for you to be making a Skype call to me than for you to be downloading a website or downloading a BitTorrent. It's all the same bits. They just see it as an opportunity to make more money off of you. Now, the interesting thing about net neutrality is it's not just me that they want to charge, not just you they want to charge, Carl. It's also the companies that are offering this service. So they would want to go to Vonage or one of the other, whoever the VoIP companies are, and say, hey, guys, if you want your VoIP to work, you're going to have to pay us money because we're not going to allow your VoIP traffic. I think that as soon as companies start doing that, start saying, you know, this bit is better than that bit, this data is allowed, this data is not allowed, they're turning it essentially, and this is why it's the cable companies doing it first and foremost. They want it to be a cable company where they choose what content you see and you pay for the content. And you can get, yeah, sure, you can get MTV for free, but you want HBO, you're going to be paying.
Yeah. There is also another article on ISPs, they're afraid of HD video on the internet and other streaming video, because if all of their customers suddenly started watching those streams from ABC instead of watching it on their TV, that it would cost them a lot more money. And that,
well,
they say it would cripple the internet.
There's more. That's true. I mean, but that's true. You know, we're using the internet more and more, right? Even if we're just looking at websites, we're using more data. They're not proposing, by the way, to charge more per bit, or to say if you use a certain number of bits. I mean, companies do offer this. If you can download a certain number of bits a month, and more than that, we're going to charge you. That's not what they're saying, and that would solve that problem. That's not what they really want. They want to put the cape. They want to keep their business. They want to put these broadcasters who are trying to go direct to their customer, they want to put them out of business. Shaw is a cable company. Comcast is a cable company. If CBS doesn't need the cable to get to its customers, they're in trouble. So that's what's at root going on here. It's the phone company. Go ahead.
Sorry. This article also mentioned that DSL companies, when they're selling DSL access, they sometimes go as high as 25-1 for ratio access.
Yeah, that bugs
to the
me
internet.
Too. Yeah. And that's another case
of, if you get to be 25 cents only a customer.
Right. Yeah. And that's a case of where if you're not getting the service you want, you should move on. I'm hoping the market, the problem is we had this shakeout. We used to have lots of internet service providers. There's just a handful now. And guess what? The minute that happens, what happens? They say, well, here's our chance. We've got a monopoly. Let's squeeze them. That's why monopolies are always a bad thing, because then they can squeeze you. When there's choice, they can't. They have to compete. Carl, thanks for the Canadian perspective. I appreciate it. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, KFI, AM 640. More stimulating talk radio.
Hate that behind-the-eight-ball Monday morning feeling? Stay in the loop all weekend long. More stimulating weekends.
KFI AM 640.
KFI, Leo Laporte, the tech guy on KFI AM 640. More stimulating talk radio. Are enough net neutrality. I could go on and on. I suppose what I should do, to be fair, is get somebody from a cable company, a phone company on, to give us their balanced opinions. But I ain't going to do it because I don't think they deserve that. Who said they? I don't have to be fair. It's obvious. I guess you could make the point, couldn't you, that I am arguing in my favor. Stuff, what I want. I don't want to pay extra. I don't think there's any reason I should have to pay extra. Bits is bits. If you want to charge me for more speed, or you want to charge me for the number of bits, okay. But bits is bits. I don't want to be charged more because a bit is part of a VoIP package or a packet of audio from a podcast than it is from a website. First of all, they'd have to observe what I'm doing, wouldn't they, to be able to even do that? I don't want them to do that either. John Pasadena, KFI, Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hello, John. Thanks for hanging on. Welcome to KFI.
Oh, thanks, Leo. I'm exploring the world of putting my photos on a slideshow on a DVD or a video CD, and I don't know which way I should go with that. Should I put it on a DVD or a CD, and what's the difference and advantages and so forth?
Well, okay, that's a great question. If you put it on a there's really, the question is more, do I do a data disc or a video disc? A data disc will hold more, but can only be played in a computer and some specialized DVD players.
Mm-hmm.
A video disc, whether it's a CD or DVD, will be able to be played in the DVD player on a TV.
Uh-huh.
And so you can send it to Aunt Jane, who doesn't even have a computer, and she can watch it.
I see.
So that's decision number one. Am I making a data disc or a video disc? Now, if you're going to make a video disc, it's usually better to make a DVD because Aunt Jane may not have a sophisticated enough DVD player to handle VCDs, which is the video CD format.
Is that a special kind of disc, a video CD?
It's the same as a regular physical CD. It's just special formatting.
Oh,
it is.
Did you buy it like that?
No.
Oh.
No, no. You can use any blank CD, but you tell your software, what we're burning here, and this is actually all across the board, you're telling your software, what we're burning here is a data CD, a data DVD, a video CD, or a DVD. So the software is what determines it. It's all, you know what the truth is, John, it's all bits, right? It's all data. Mm-hmm. It's just how the data is laid out on the disk. But most modern DVD players will play a DVD or a VCD.
Yes, I noticed that.
Older DVD players don't know from VCD.
Right.
So since we don't know what Aunt Maud's got, maximum compatibility, you're going to burn a DVD.
Mm-hmm. I see.
And the limitations of that are, now it's video, so the quality's not as good.
Oh.
We're turning it into a movie.
Mm-hmm.
It's not your actual pictures. It's a movie of your pictures.
Oh, okay.
So that's limitation number one. You know, the resolution goes down to 400 lines or 500 lines. And, you know, it's a little smearier. It's interlaced, all of that stuff.
On the DVD.
On the DVD or a VCD. DVD's a little bit better quality.
Oh, it is. Okay.
And we also recompress it because it's got to be an MPEG-2 format for the DVD and an MPEG-1 format for the VCD. So we degrade the quality a little bit in order to make it more compatible.
And if I have a Pentium 4 1.5 processor speed, would I be able to put an external DVD burner that I don't have now onto that kind of?
Oh yeah,
that would fit. Okay.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it's a question of the physical space for it. But if you have the physical, you know, if you look at the inside and there's a slot for it and there's a cable for it, mm-hmm. The computer certainly can handle it. Yeah.
And I could do an external drive to the USB.
Oh, I'm sorry. You said external. Yeah. If you're going to do external, make sure you have USB 2
right.
or FireWire because USB 1 is not fast enough.
Right. Is it easy for a tech to put a FireWire cable on a computer that doesn't have one?
Yeah, or you could do it easily.
Is
it's
really?
About $30 for it's just a PCI card. Have you ever put a card in your computer?
Yes, I have.
Same thing.
That's all it is.
Yep.
And is 256 RAM enough for that DVD external, or should
it
go higher?
It's light. If you're going to do, because it's not so much the playback. It's the authoring tools that you're going to use.
The burning.
You want a little more memory on that, I think. 512. But while you got it open, just get another stick of RAM. RAM's cheap.
Yeah. Well, that's very helpful. Thank you so much.
You're welcome, John. I think it's a very good project. In fact, it really is an easy way to get family and friends to go, wow, you're good.
Exactly.
Well, because what happens is, and all the software will do it. I like ULEED's slideshow. What is it called? A DVD slideshow, I think. Or DVD movie. I can't remember the name of it. But anyway, ULEED makes a good one, ULEAD, but there are a lot of different companies. But what happens is all of these will allow you to do music behind it.
Right.
Dissolves. You can do the Ken Burns effect, you know, where you move the picture around. And people just think you're a genius.
Is Adobe Photoshop Elements one of your favorites?
Very good. Yeah.
That's what I was thinking.
Does it have a capability?
Yeah, apparently. Apparently, I wasn't quite sure what it burns to from the package.
What you want to read is it going to make a data disk or is it going to make a video disk? And if it, you know, and that's the question.
Okay.
Going back to the beginning when we started talking about this, a lot of computer programs think of data, is this disk going to be able to, it'll say in the box, can play back in any DVD player or something like that. If it says requires computer for playback, that's not what you want.
Oh, okay.
Well, depending what you're going to do with it. Are you going to give it to somebody who only has a DVD player?
Just bring the family and friends.
Yeah, that's what. Then you probably do want it that way.
Okay.
But it's like, I mean, you're basically making a movie.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very simple with these programs, and it just knocks people off. I mean, they just go, wow, you are, John, you're brilliant.
The new Steven Spielberg,
that.
Right?
Yeah, you don't have to tell them how easy it was.
Well,
thanks, John.
Thanks a lot.
Yeah, take care. My pleasure. That's one of the neat things about software. It'll do things that, you know, Ken Burns invented this. You know, kind of this pan and scan technique. He used it first, as I remember, in the Civil War documentary. Remember? So here's your problem. You're going to do a documentary in the Civil War. There's no video. There's no footage from the Civil War. All you got is a lot of still pictures. How do you make a video documentary? Well, he said, well, it's easy. We don't move the picture. We move the camera. So he takes a picture and he zooms into somebody's face, or he pans across a group of people, and it adds motion to a still picture, and it is a wonderful effect. They call it the Ken Burns effect because he was the first to use it really a lot. Nowadays, on a Mac with iPhoto or iMovie, on PCs with good software, you push a button, and it says, where do you want to start? Okay, Photoshop Elements will do this. Where do you want to start? Okay, where do you want to end? Okay, no problem, we'll make the move. And you get these beautiful, smooth effects. You choose the right music, you do a little cutting, and you're all of a sudden, you're Ken Burns. What Ken Burns, you know, 20 years, millions of dollars to do, anybody can do with pictures of mom and dad. And that's what this is all about. That's the computer revolution right there for you. So, let's see, we've got a couple minutes more. Let's see if we can squeeze in John from Michigan. Hello, John. Welcome. KFI, Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Yeah, hi, Leo.
Hi, John.
Yeah, I've got a Palm TX handheld, and I was looking for a GPS unit. And I see Palm has some GPS receivers that hook into it with some TomTom software. I don't know if you know anybody who's had any experience with those. Or
yeah, we've played with them. They're good. A couple of issues. You're going to use it in a car?
Yeah.
One problem is you're going to be charging it, and because you'll run out of juice real quick.
Okay.
Because it's working pretty hard. And so if you're going on a trip that's more than a few hours, you're going to have to get a car charger for the Palm.
Okay.
And you're going to have to keep it plugged in. It means there's going to be wires hanging around.
Okay.
But that's true anytime you've got this kind of GPS car kit. I think the TX is a very good Palm. It's a very fast Palm, and so it's a good choice for this. It has a nice screen. And yeah, I like the TomTom software. I think that's very good. A couple of companies make these. Palm is not making it themselves, I don't think. I think they're reselling somebody's.
They had two of them on their website, and I've seen some other ones out there too. I just wondered.
I would say there it's not as good as a standalone GPS unit. But you've already paid for the computer. So now you're adding that capability to the computer, and it is cheaper for that reason. You know, they're only a couple of $100, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I think the Copilot or the TomTom, those would be my two choices. The Copilot's been doing it for a long time, and I think they're very good. And because, you know, there's no reason to buy it. You know, that's what a GPS is. It's some software, a radio receiver, actually a couple of radio receivers, and a computer, and you've already got the computer. So that saves some expense on that. Yeah, I think that's a good way to go. And I like the Copilots of the two. Although I haven't had a lot of experience with the TomTom, and I do like TomTom standalone units. So I think they're probably fine too. I think that's one of the things with GPS. There's not a lot of difference between the units. It's almost a commodity product right now. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, KFI AM 640, more stimulating talk radio.
The stimulating talk you want. The news, weather, and traffic you need. KFI AM 640, Southern California's newsroom.
I hope you're sitting down, folks, because not only is DSL Extreme offering the lowest price in the nation for high-speed internet, I've mentioned this before, $12.95 a month. They've sweetened the deal. I don't know how you could make it any better. Now you're getting the first month free. I don't know how they do it. DSL Extreme high-speed internet, $12.95 a month already, the lowest price ever, and your first month is free. Now, I don't have to convince you that high-speed internet's the way to go. I mean, for downloading music and movies and television shows, for surfing the net, no matter what, everything is better on high-speed. And if you've avoided it because you thought it was too expensive, now it's less than dial-up in many cases. AOL dial-up is twice as much. I am a DSL Extreme customer. I love it. I use it, and I recommend it. No spam. You get rid of that second phone line. You probably save money, and you get high-speed internet from the best in the business for just $12.95 a month. So let me give you the number, because this is a limited-time offer, and I know some restrictions apply. So call 866-2-GET-NET right now, 866-2-GET-NET. You can also sign up online. Check the availability in your area. DSLExtreme.com is the website. 866-2-GET-NET to get high-speed internet for the lowest price in the nation, $12.95 a month, and get the first month free only from DSL Extreme.
Dale Dye, tomorrow evening, 5 to 7 p.m., KFI, AM 640. More stimulating talk radio.
KFI, the tech guy, Leo Laporte on KFI AM 640. More stimulating talk radio. We're talking high tech. You know, one of the things I really love about this subject is the variety of stuff we get to talk about. It's just it's a broad range of things. That's fun. You know, it's not boring because there's, you know, it's so many different things and different areas you can go into, and a lot of stuff going on. Let's say hi to Brian. He is calling. Where are you calling from, Brian? I don't see a location here. Are you there, Brian?
Leo, hang on.
Oh, okay.
Get off the speakerphone. I'm here.
Okay,
I'm from Ventura.
Brian.
Leo.
Ventura, yes. What
Ventura,
can I do for
California.
You?
California.
Yes, sir.
Leo, I'm having trouble formatting a CDRW.
Okay.
Seems like my computer has more than one formatting option. I have direct CD that's actually running right now, and it's been running right for over an hour. I have another one. I'm not sure I pronounce it correctly. Veritas,
yeah.
Veritas, DLA.
Okay.
And that was running. I tried one for that. It ran for 3 hours, and depending on how the estimated time left was running, it was had 3 to 6 more hours left to go on.
Oh, my golly. Holy moly.
So I'm not. And then I believe I have a Roxio CD utility on here, too.
The only time you need to format a disk is if you're using what we call packet writing or UDF of format. And that allows you to use a CD as if it were a drive where you just drag files onto it. And that's what the Direct CD does. That's what the DLA does. And the Roxio, I don't know what Roxio software you're using, but I'm sure that's what it is. Is it some sort of packet writing system? Is that what you want? You want to be able to drag and drop files onto the
Well, what
CD?
I really want to be able to do is, with QuickBooks, I want to be able to, you know, do the backup command and have it write right to it. Now,
In that case, you do need a packet writing program.
Okay. I did use Direct CD, and I have one that's formatted with using that utility.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And I hit the backup, and I go browse, and I go to it's in my D drive. And I hit OK for the D drive, and it changes it to C drive burning folder.
Yeah. There's true packet writing and there's pseudo writing. And what XP does is kind of a pseudo writing. If you don't have any software at all and you want to burn a CD on XP, you put in a disk. It doesn't format it. It just says, okay, what do you want to do? And you say, I want to copy some files. And you copy some files. It actually hasn't done anything yet. It's made a folder on the hard drive that is a image of what it's going to do. And then when you eject the disk or you say commit, then it does standard track at once writing, which is, the two different ways you can burn data onto a CD are packet writing, where it treats it more like a hard drive where you copy bits at a time, or track at once where it just kind of, you know, burns it all the way through. That's kind of the more traditional CD burning. That's how XP does it. That's kind of tricking it into looking like packet writing. Now, Quicken would be happy with that, or QuickBooks would be happy with that, because it doesn't know that it's not writing directly or whatever. It just thinks it's writing to a disk.
Okay.
The key with that, and in some ways that's easier. You don't have to do formatting. It's not going to take hours to format the disk, et cetera, et cetera. It's just writing to it. The key with that, though, is you've got to remember to commit. And I think people are often fooled thinking, oh, I've made a copy. And then they go home or they turn off the computer or whatever. There isn't a copy on that CD. They bring the CD home. It's blank. It only writes to it after you say commit, or when you eject, it's supposed to. Sometimes it forgets to say, oh, do you want to burn the disk now? You have to burn. And so that looks like a burn has happened, and it hasn't yet. And that's a common area of confusion.
If I go to the folder that has the file, the burning file in it, where's the button to push to make it burn?
Well, basically, it should be on the folder of the CD itself, or when you just press the eject button to eject the CD, it should pop up and say, do you want me to burn this?
It's not doing that.
Yeah, something's kind of wrong. It sounds like, and by the way, this is very common. Something's kind of wrong with it. The other thing is formatting will be, you know, there's DVD-Rs and there's DVD-RWs. Do you have a read-write or a write?
These are RWs.
They are read-write. That's why it's taken so long to format. It's faster to format a DVD-R or plus R.
Can I ask one more question?
You can if you hold on.
Okay.
I'm going to put you on hold. We got to take a break for news, but we'll be back in a bit. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, KFI AM 640, more stimulating talk radio.
May 27th, 2006.
Partly cloudy tonight and windy, lows in the 50s, and it should warm up tomorrow, 70s and 80s for metro LA and Orange counties on Sunday. 66 right now in Los Alamitos, 70 in Santa Ana, 69 in Burbank, and 68 in Marina Del Rey. KFI is the talk station that does live local news on the hour, on the half, and when it breaks. At 12:06, I'm Jessica Rosenthal, KFI News.
KFI AM 640, more stimulating talk radio. I'm Leo Laporte, the tech guy on KFI. Before the break, we were talking about backup, and with Brian and Ventura, I wanted to keep him online because I think this is a subject that we all need to know more about. We need to talk about more. Backing up is so important, and I tell you, I'd like to talk to you now, Brian, while you still got your data, because otherwise I will be hearing from you in a year when you go, I lost all my books. They're gone. So it's really good that you're thinking about this now. My general philosophy on backup is you want to make it as easy as possible. If it's at all difficult, if it's at all tricky, you won't do it. You'll put it off. You won't think about it. QuickBooks has a nice feature. It's automatic. When you exit the program, Quicken 2, it'll back it up to a hard drive. It just goes boom. I would use that feature. That way, you kind of have this short-term, easy backup. You don't even have to think about it. It's always there. What you do have to think about is once a week, and it's not just your QuickBooks data. You should be backing up other data, I'm sure. There's stuff you want to keep. So once a week, I just take my Documents folder, and I burn it to a CD, and I pop it out, and I put it on the shelf, or better yet, take it home, and I've got copies. And I have a copy for every week. And that way, I never have to worry. Now, if your My Documents folder is too big for a CD, use a DVD. But or if you have to split it up. But it's really nice. If it gets, you know, really big, if it's more than 4.7 gigabytes, which is the size of a DVD, that's time probably to think about buying an external hard drive that you can back up to. And maybe a couple. And if you're in business and this is serious data, buy two and rotate them. Take one home. The key is fast and easy or you won't do it. Okay, you had another question, Brian? Go ahead.
While the Veritas formatting is running, I go up to my task manager because my computer just totally bogs down.
Right, and it's busy.
It's very busy. It's like the CPU is at 100%. Is that a normal thing or is something else going on?
It shouldn't really take much of the computer's thought to do this. It's fairly simple, but I think that's probably a normal situation.
Okay.
You make sure you have the latest version. You've downloaded the latest from Symantec and all of that. Actually, it probably came with your DVD writer, didn't it?
It came with the computer, I believe.
Yeah. See, that's part of the problem is that...
Or it was bundled in something else.
These bundles are free, and they're often not as good as the full paid version. I don't like Disk at Once. I think it's too risky. For instance, now if you use this DLA or use NCD, these are all the same things where you not Disk at Once, where you do packet writing. The problem is you copy it, you have to finalize it before you can read it. You're never sure you got it all. It's convenient in the sense that it's acting like a hard drive, but it always makes me feel like I'm not really sure I've got a backup. So, and given the trouble you're having with this, I think it might be a prudent thing to just burn CDs. You know, you have Nero or Roxio, right? Once a week, just sit down, put a blank CD in there, open up Roxio and say, copy my documents over. Press the burn button. It shouldn't take more than about 5 or 10 minutes to burn the whole thing, and you'll have a copy. I don't know why DLA has taken all of your CPU up. How modern a computer is it? Is it really old?
It's an HP 5500 laptop.
It's a laptop.
2 years old.
Yeah.
Pentium 3.
It's taken up all the time because it's not the fastest thing in the world, and it's busy. I think just another reason not to use it.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. It's something that came with a computer. It was free. I'm not crazy about it. I don't think you need it, and I don't think it's safe, frankly. And safety is very important. With backing up, the key is to get this. I mean, the simple rule is make copies of stuff that you don't have copies of otherwise. So you don't copy Windows. You've got the Windows install CD. You don't copy applications. You've got those applications. You're just copying the data, the stuff that you made that you don't have any other copy of. And usually that's in the My Documents folder. If you want settings and other stuff like that, it's in your login folder, your home folder. You copy that. And that's really pretty much everything you want. Now, if you've got photos or music in there, it balloons up really big. If you didn't have photos or music or videos in your My Documents folder, the whole thing wouldn't be more than a gigabyte, probably. And it's rare that it would get more than that. I guess, you know, your Outlook file can get that big if you keep all your email. But it should fit on a DVD. If you don't include, and that's what I would say, I would just back up everything except those photos. You do need to back up the photos. The problem with music and photos is just so much data. I have 60 gigabytes of music alone. I have about 50 gigabytes of photos. Well, I'm not going to fit those on. I'm not going to use 20 DVDs. Even with the Blu-ray DVDs, it's going to take a couple or three. So the best thing for that case is just to go out and get my book from Western Digital or some large external hard drive and just, hook it up and copy the data over and have two copies. Offsite's important because if there's a fire, an earthquake, a flood, and your entire office or home gets destroyed, it's important to have a copy that is not in your office or home. So that's also important. It's not really backed up if everything is there. And I'll tell you, I know this from bitter experience, not personal experience, although I have lost my share of data lately. Talked about it last week. I lost a whole bunch of podcasts that I hadn't yet published. So they're gone. I had to re-record them. But I have a friend who's a novelist who had a novel in process, and she was very good about backing up. Hey, if you write novels, I was paranoid. When I write my books, I have a USB drive, and I copy every chapter, every page practically. I'm constantly backing up to the USB drive. And then when I'm done, I take it with me. She was backing up on it probably in those days. It was floppies. This was about 10 years ago. And there was a big fire in her neighborhood. Hundreds of houses burned. It was a very serious fire. And her house burnt down. Not only did it burn her computer down with a novel in it, it burned down all her backups because that's the only place she had them. She didn't take them off site. She had to rewrite that novel from scratch. Imagine that. I mean, that's a nightmare. That's devastating. So I learned from her sad experience. She did rewrite it and published it, but I mean, who knows what that first edition was like, right? Was it better the second time? I don't know. We never know. It got burned. So very important to not only make a copy of your data and do it kind of regularly, I think to take it off site is important. In fact, really the best backup strategy involves kind of short-term, medium-term, and long-term backup. Or sometimes they call it near-term storage, offline storage. I think it's a good idea to have a USB key or a CD or something in your computer that you can always back up to. And do that as you're working. When I'm writing a book, as I said, I'm back up all the time. You know, every time I get up to go to the bathroom or to get a cup of tea or whatever, back up. Back it up on that USB key. Because if that hard drive dies, I've got it on the USB key. But then at the end of every workday, you might want to burn a CD. If you're writing something and it's really important, you might want to make a printout. Yeah, because then in the worst case, you can always type it in again, but you got a copy. And then take it with you. Take it to the office. Or if you're at the office, take it home. If you have a home office, get a safe deposit box or a friend. But just get it in a different location. Mail it to yourself. Well, that's not a bad way to go, by the way. People upload, I mean, for something small like a book, uploading it to X-Drive or off-site storage is a great way to go. The problem is, of course, upload, it takes time, and These are limited in size. There's a lovely site called box.net that gives you a gigabyte free. You can just up, I mean, and gigabyte's a lot. As I said, your My Documents folder probably isn't more than that. So if you're working on something, you got a presentation, something vital, a novel, a song, something you just, you can't, oh boy, if I lost this, I would cry myself to sleep. That's a good case to log into box.net, B-O-X.net, create an account. It's absolutely free. And then you can upload it there. Now you've, I mean, that's great. I mean, assuming, you know, it would have to be a sequence of catastrophes to lose it. You have to lose your computer. You'd have to lose whatever backups you made. And box.net would have to go down with no backup. It would just, it would have to be, you know, it'd be the end of the world. Nuclear attack. Anything short of that, you're safe. So that, I think that's pretty good. $5 a month, you get 5 gigabytes. That's really offline storage. So if you, look, if this stuff is important to you, if it's backup, you know, financial data or stuff you can't afford to lose, those are the kinds of solutions you need. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, KFI AM 640. More of your calls coming up in just a bit on KFI AM 640. More stimulating talk radio.
Dr. Dean Adel, this afternoon at 2.
KFI AM 640.
KFI AM 640. More stimulating talk radio. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Taking calls, talking high tech. If it's got a chip in it, we will talk about it. Everything from backup to net neutrality. We've had good conversations today. Let's go to Jim in Escondido. I like your idea, Jim. Go ahead. Welcome to KFI.
Hi.
Hi, Jim.
Okay, I've got a two-part question. I pulled the hard drive out of a computer that was definitely going belly up on me.
Okay.
And I cannot find the address book anywhere, and it's got a list of about 200 names and phone numbers, and I can't find it anywhere. How do I go about looking for it?
All right, so what program was the address book in?
Well, it was under Outlook Express.
Okay, so it's a WAB. W-A-B file. That's the Windows address book.
Okay.
So that's what you're searching for. Any W-A-B file you can find, save. Now, you say you made a backup. What
yes.
did you back? What did you back up?
Well, I backed up everything onto a new hard drive.
But everything, what do you mean everything? The whole drive or...
Just everything and anything that I thought was important.
Yeah, because, see, you can miss stuff like that, right? Because you don't know what that WAB file is. What was that WAB file? Is that important? I don't know. Should I back it up? Nah, it probably not. So that's the question. Now, Outlook can store those WAB files in a number of locations.
Uh-huh.
It is probably, unfortunately, stored in the Outlook Express folder, which is in the Applications folder, which is not where you're probably looking for backup data. I hate it when programs put your data in the program files folder.
Right.
Why would you look in the program files? That's where programs are supposed to live. If it's data, if it's my data, put it in my data file, you know, my documents.
Exactly.
But older Windows programs did this, so it may be that you didn't back it up.
Oh, no. Well, I'm going to go look it anyway.
Do a search for WAB files. It will be in there.
All right.
And if you have no WAB files, you have no address book, I'm sorry to say.
All right. Great. Well, at least you pointed me in the right direction. Now, number two, we're going to have a family reunion the end of this September, and everybody is going to be contributing pictures, movies, and all this. And we all want to store it on, let's say, CDs and DVDs. And we plan on the time cap. We're putting together a time capsule, and it's going to be opened up in about 50 to 75 years.
Don't put it on a DVD. Nobody will. They'll go, wow, this silver disc is pretty. I wonder what's on it.
Yeah, well, just like I say to my kids, well, you know, have you ever heard of 8mm? And they have no idea what I'm talking about.
And even if they'd heard of it, how would they play it?
Exactly. So,
and
how am I?
And that wasn't that long ago, right? So,
no.
50 years. You know, there might be CD players around, but I don't think you can guarantee it.
We're thinking maybe we should put in a time capsule a CD player.
No, because then how? I mean, will USB be around or FireWire? That's even less likely.
Or a electricity.
Who knows 50 years from now? If you're making a time capsule, you put prints in, because as long as they're eyes, they'll be able to see them.
Okay.
You cannot assume this is people don't think about this. We it's funny how humans are so short-sighted. We think about the present. We're good at the present. And we think everything we've got now will be the same in 50 years. But look back, 50 years ago was 1956.
Uh-huh.
Were there 8-tracks? No. Were there cassettes? No. Were there CDs? No. 50 years from now, and by the way, change is accelerating. So the difference between 1956 and now is actually less than the difference between now and 2056. That's going to be much different. So there's a couple of things. For us, what we do with our backups is every few years we say, I see CDs are disappearing. I better move it to a new format. That's not such a big deal. But a time capsule, you don't have that luxury. You need to put it in a format that's going to be universal. And I mean, a print is about the only way I can think you could guarantee that.
It seems like every 10 or 12 years, I'm taking all my music and backing it up on a different media form, and it's starting to drive me nuts.
If the music industry had their way, you'd buy it all over again. Think about it. I'm
sick and tired of buying the Beach Boys' greatest hits.
Exactly. Smiley Smile, I've got album, I've got cassette, I've got CD, and I've got an iTunes version of it.
Exactly. And, then what are you going to play it on even 25 years from now?
Right.
That's why I was asking. It sounds kind of like a crazy question.
It's not.
But seriously, everybody wants to put together a time capsule.
It's a great question.
And we're trying to, we're trying to figure out what would be the best way to, because there's going to be a few of us that aren't going to be around.
Right.
Yeah. Maybe we'll get the last laugh.
What are these? I don't know what they were doing then, but boy, they had some pretty silver jewelry. I'm gonna make a necklace out of this.
Exactly. Yeah.
Let's talk about data formats. I'll tell you, the good news is that once it's in bits, it's a lot easier. Now that when you had a physical format like a cassette or an 8-track, you had to have that player. You had to have an 8-millimeter player. But once it's bits are kind of universal. The only issue is how they're stored. And because they're bits, you can move them around infinitely without any degradation. So I think we're at the dawn of a new era now where once things are converted to bits, as long as we kind of keep track of this stuff, we're going to be able to play it back. Let's talk a little bit about what would you do? I'd love to hear from other people, too. What would you do if you were making a time capsule 50 years from now? You wanted them to be able to play it back. Let's think about that and talk more about it in just a bit. Leo Laporte, the tech guy on KFI AM 640, more stimulating talk radio.
Information doesn't take the weekend off.
Neither do we.
KFI, all weekend long.
KFI AM 640, more stimulating talk radio. I'm Leo Laporte, the tech guy on KFI. I hope you've done some thinking about Jim's question. I loved that question. How would you make a time capsule? What would you put in it so you could guarantee they could play it back 50 years from now? I think it's pretty clear the answer is there's nothing you could put it on. Hard drive? No. If you put it on 8-inch floppies 20 years ago, thinking that in 2006 we'd be able to read 8-inch floppies, you'd be mistaken. Now, I suppose I could find an 8-inch floppy drive somewhere, maybe. Maybe, but that was only 20 years ago. And I guarantee you there are disk formats from 20 years ago that I can't play back. So I think you've got to be really careful about this. How are we going to store it? And here's one. Online? What if you put it online? Well, in a way, online isn't really solving the problem. You're giving it to somebody else. And that person every few years will figure out, we've got this website. We better transfer it to the new holographic memory. So that's not going to work. In fact, really, there's a project to keep websites alive because it's called the Internet Archive. Because if you think about it, we've seen a lot. It's amazing what we've seen in the last 10 years. The Internet is not that old. The World Wide Web was invented in 1989. It's not even 20 years old. And yet there have been millions and millions of pages many of which are gone. So the goal of the Internet Archive is to archive all this stuff, to save it. And I mean, right now they're putting it on hard drives. They've got big hard drives. But what they're going to have to do every few years is kind of assess how they're storing this stuff and move it over. The good news is I think it's safe to assume that drive space and storage, whatever the medium, will be cheaper and more plentiful in times to come. Whether we go to, you know, I think it's very likely in the next 10 years we'll see storage, holographic storage that allows you to store huge amounts in the size, you know, a cube of, you know, the size of a, you know, a Rubik's cube could perhaps have 20 terabytes in it. Let's check back in 10 years and see if I was right. But in that case, you just, you know, but while one medium isn't quite dead yet and the new medium is coming on, you transfer it over. But you can't do that in a time capsule. It's buried. Really, if you ask me, the only thing you can do with a time capsule is put stuff in an eternal format, like prints. Something somebody could pick up, hold, and look at. There is no electronic storage medium that I would trust for the next 50 years that I would be able to, I don't think about it. What could you put it on that 50 years from now, you could guarantee somebody would be able to read that? There's nothing. And it's important to think about that because we're putting all of our pictures and things that we love on these discs and hoping against hope they'll still be around. Who knows? Who knows? I don't know. Let's say hi to Jeff. He's on the line from Michigan via Skype. Hello, Jeff. Welcome to KFI.
How you doing, Leo?
How do you solve that problem? What do you think? Is there any way to do that?
I think your internet idea is probably your best bet. But who knows with this net neutrality stuff?
Yeah, that's true. But I guess if it's on the net, the advantage is that there's somebody at the data center who's keeping an eye on things. You don't,
right.
If you go on a website, you don't know what it's stored on. You don't care. You just presume right. That it's getting fed to me somehow.
Might as well just pass the problem to someone else.
Let somebody else deal with it. That's right. What can I do for you today?
Well, I've been confronted by a client who wants to do some videocasting and some podcasting. And right. I've been going over kind of solutions for it. And we're not looking to get as big as you, really. We don't plan on getting as big as you. Mm-hmm. But we do want to keep it in-house. So okay. I was actually looking at kind of the Apple X serves and maybe even doing some flash streaming and stuff like that. I'm wondering if you had any suggestions.
So you're doing video?
Yes.
Not exclusively audio, but you're going to do video.
It will be both.
And who do you want to see this? You said, is it all the audience going to be in-house?
No. We want to do some streaming video and, you know, kind of iTunes distribution and things like that.
Okay, so it'll be public.
Right.
Yeah, okay. Well, I'll tell you, the people I would look at right now who I think are doing the best job of video online is Rocket Boom. You ever see Rocket Boom?
Yeah.
Yeah, rocketboom.com. Now, they've got one model where, you know, you just go to their site, rocketboom.com, and it starts playing. And the quality is excellent. It looks good. It is QuickTime, so it's a standard format video.
Right.
And most people can see it. Now, if you don't have QuickTime installed and you go to their site, you'll get a little queue, a blue queue, and it says you have to download QuickTime. But, you know, that's a pretty... The nice thing is it's an H.260... Actually, I think theirs is MPEG-4, but the quality is very good for the bandwidth that they use. And so those are a couple of things to keep in mind is how much storage, how much bandwidth, how good do I want it to look? And I think that's a good compromise.
We've actually getting the T1 line installed for the client, and we're actually looking on hosting the content ourselves.
That even gets more complicated because these files are huge, right? So yep. now you're talking about a lot of, I mean, a T1 line, that's nothing.
Mm-hmm.
T1 is 1.44 megabits, right?
I believe actually we're going to be getting three
okay.
up and down.
So you're going to get a T3 line.
Yeah.
That's nothing. Get
right.
ready.
Yeah.
If it becomes popular, my website, the Twit website, we have a 100 megabit line.
Uh-huh.
100 megabit. That's 30 times more than that. And
right.
it sometimes gets bogged down. So the real question is, I mean, we have so many things that you have to look at, but one of them is how many people, how many people are going to download this? And the way podcasting works, everybody tries to get the file at the same time.
Yeah.
So hosting it yourself is sometimes a bad idea because it's very peaky data. They need, you know, it'll get very quiet in between releases when nobody's using any data at all, and all of a sudden everybody hits the site at exactly the same time. We brought down Libsyn, which has huge pipes, by offering a large video file. 10,000 people tried to get it at the same time, and boom, the site went down for a day. So just a word of warning. Video is big. Video can be really big. I do like Flash because it's universal. The nice thing about Flash, if you go to Google Video, that's who's doing that's Flash Video.
Yep.
And that's nice because anybody can play it. They don't have to do anything about it. Yahoo Video is going to be Flash. Most of the sites where they don't want users to have to think about it, it's Flash. I think the Flash quality is lower. So that's the trade-off. I like QuickTime. I like what Andrew's doing at Rocket Boom. It looks great, but it's a problem for some people because they don't have QuickTime. So they get there, they get the blue queue, and you got to download QuickTime. On the other hand, almost everybody has Flash, but the quality's lower. So these are the kinds of things that you're balancing, Jeff. You have to think for your client. You have to think, how important is compatibility? And that depends on the audience. If you have a technically sophisticated audience, like as Rocket Boom does, I'd say QuickTime. What is the podcast going to be about?
Well, haven't really even started it yet. We're just kind of roughly.
I mean, what business is the client in? I mean,
it's going to be for a church, actually, a local church that wants to start doing some podcasting.
Now you know that this is a non-sophisticated audience. This isn't a techie audience. Flash, good choice. And also because if you're broadcasting sermons and things like that, video quality is not the most important thing. I mean, it's nice to see the pastor's face, but, you know, frankly, it doesn't have to be perfect. So I think for a church, Flash is a better choice. The last thing the church wants to be in, the last thing you want to be in is a tech support business where you get people going, "Hi, I wanted to see the church, the sermon, and I just get a blue queue. What's going on?" You don't want that. Flash, everybody who goes there, almost, nothing's perfect, but the vast majority of people are going to go there, press a button, and they're going to see it.
Mm-hmm.
So, and again, quality is less important. You know, we do the MacBreak podcast. We do it in high def. We're not going to do it in Flash. We're going to do it in H.264.
And well, then there's also going to be multiple formats we're going to do. I mean, we're going to have the sermons and things like that out. Also distribution on DVDs, and you know, it's not only just going to be on internet. So
my counsel would be generally start slow and build up because you'll solve a lot of problems. Don't solve all the problems at the same time. You'll be sorry.
Right.
So I would say go to your client and say, you know, let's take baby steps. Start with audio, work your way up to video. Flash is a good choice. What other questions can I answer for you? What other issues you have?
I was just, I know YouTube and Google and all them, they do Flash. How is it just Flash itself that you pop the video into? And it?
Yeah, that's who's making money on all of this as a Macromedia, now Adobe.
Yeah.
Flash 8 has a plugin. It's actually really easy. You'll create your media, and it takes a variety of different formats, commonly MPEG-4. And you literally drag and drop it, and it creates a Flash file for you, which you then put on your server. It's very easy. Flash has been a boon to this. I mean, you wouldn't see all these sites like VideoEgg, YouTube, Google Video, Yahoo Video, on and on and on, except for Flash. Flash made it doable. We were suffering in the days when there were 20 different video formats and it was impossible.
Yeah.
So I think Flash is really good. It's only not good if you don't have a literate audience. I mean, if you have a literate audience that wants higher quality or needs higher quality. But it's, you know, church sermons, nah. Flash, baby. Absolutely. And it's inexpensive. You buy Flash 8, you buy the plugin. It's very straightforward. Leo Laporte, good luck. I think that's a great project, Jeff. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, KFI, AM 640, more stimulating talk radio.
Handle on the news, warts and all, Monday morning, 6 to 7, KFI, AM 640.
Leo Laporte, tech guy, KFI, AM 640, more stimulating talk radio. We have a lot of questions these days about podcasting and internet broadcast. I love that. I really think this is a revolution of people creating their own content, their own media. You know, a church doesn't have to go out and buy a television channel and a bunch of cameras. I mean, it's easy to do. It's inexpensive, and you can outreach, and it's global. It's worldwide. I mean, that's something that regular TV can never do. You get a cable channel, you're on a cable channel, you're in that country, and that's it. If you're lucky, you're national. And I know because I produce a TV show in Canada, and that's where it is. It's in Canada. And then you have to go to each country and say, well, do you like to buy it and broadcast it? And we found a network in Australia, but we haven't found one in the U.S. But I put that video on the internet. Done deal. Anybody who wants to see it anywhere in the world, as long as they have internet access, they can see it. Talk about a revolution. No wonder the Comcasts of the world and the Time Warners of the world are panicky. Their whole business model is crumbling before their eyes. They're looking at the record industry thinking, oh boy, what happened? Damon Ventura, KFI, Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hello, Damon.
Hello, Leo. I have a number of multi-page PDFs that I need to turn into multi-page TIFFs, and you only using software.
Can't you just save them as TIFFs?
I can, but when I save them as TIFFs, they're only individual.
Oh,
files.
It's one page at a time.
Right. Now,
so
I
want one big, massive graphic?
Yes. Well, I downloaded ImageMagick from Fink. And it has a convert program as part of that, and it's able to do that. The only problem is it creates such a huge cache file that my hard drive can't really keep up. You know, I get to
Of course it does. I mean, if you think what it's doing, it's a lot of work.
Right.
Yeah, normally when you save a PDF in any format, it's each page for itself, and there's good reason. Otherwise, these files get huge.
Right. They're going into an archiving system which only accepts PDFs or hand scanned, and that's a lot of paper to print out and then scan.
Well, so it won't accept individual TIFFs?
No, it won't. It won't compile those individual TIFFs into that individual TIFF file.
I see. Well, you know, you got me. That's an interesting question. I'm going to put it in the show notes. Because we're pre-recording this, I can't say to the audience, call and give us your answer. And I don't off the top. It's something that nobody's ever asked me. Why? You know, because what a strange thing.
I've never had to deal with before.
What a strange thing to want to do.
Yeah. Well, I said, why don't they want PDFs? That's ridiculous.
Right. Or why don't they want individual TIFF file?
Right.
I mean, you could name them in a way that they would be all the same file.
Well, and that's one issue too. You know, this ImageMagick program, the convert, will allow me to take in individual TIFFs. You know, if I save individual TIFFs out of PDF, it'll take them fine as long as I have them named appropriately. Put the percent 03D for the decimal point.
Is ImageMagick free?
Yes, it is.
Yeah, that's a Unix program. But is there a Windows version of that?
Not that I'm aware of.
No, you're running it on Unix.
It's the Fink distribution. That's correct.
Think. Yeah. I mean, I'm looking here. I mean, I just did a little search, and I have found a program or a program or two that will do this. Here's one. Freebird, convert PDF to image formats, including multiple page TIFFs.
Okay.
So, but gosh, what is it? Is it a Windows? I can't even figure out what it is. Is it a Windows program? Is it? It looks like it's a server.
Yeah, that's another thing I've run into. Is some say, we can do it. Buy our scanner for $32,000.
Yeah. Holy cow. You set up a source. Oh, you know, this might be good for you, though. Do you have a lot of them to do?
Yes.
So here's
over
the deal. You set up a source folder where users can drop their PDF documents. The Freebird workflow server, this is obviously intended for law offices and other places that deal with a lot of documents like this, watches for that folder, automatically converts arriving PDFs into graphics, which are placed in a different folder. Boy, that couldn't be easier. I think, in other words, Google it. There are programs that will do what you want, which is multiple page TIFFs.
Right.
So what I would do is do a Google for PDF and multi-page or multiple-page TIFF.
Okay.
And I found one. I bet you there are others as well. I mean, obviously, this is an expensive one. The nice thing about ImageMagick, it's open source and free.
Right.
Interesting question, Damon. I'll put it in the show notes. Maybe somebody will, if you're listening, go to the show notes and maybe you can comment and help Damon out. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, KFI, AM 640, more stimulating talk radio.
May 27, 2006.
It's 65 right now in Irvine, 66 in Newport Beach, 68 in Santa Monica, and 71 in Glendale. KFI is the talk station that does live local news on the hour, on the half, and when it breaks. At 106, I'm Jessica Rosenthal, KFI News.
Leo Laporte, the tech guy, KFI, AM 640, more stimulating talk radio. Dr. Dean Adell coming up in just about an hour. Then it's a fresh John and Ken from 3 to 5 tonight. Another great day, Memorial Day weekend here on KFI. And lots of phone calls, lots of great questions. You know, I'm stumped sometimes, and that's fine. I don't mind. I like getting stumped. One of the things that's fun about doing this show is I learn so much. So if I don't know an answer, I'll research it, or a listener will answer it. And I'm talking about the last question with a multi-page TIFF. And I'm sure by now in the show notes there's a good answer. Henry Riverside, KFI, AM 640, more stimulating talk radio. Hello, Henry. How are you?
Better than I deserve, Leo. How are you doing?
You know what, Henry? I'm the same. Always better than I deserve.
Me too. I had a couple of quick questions about an airport extreme base station.
Yes.
Actually, it's an airport express, but I'm using an airport extreme as my base.
Yes. You're using the WDS, which is really great. I do the same thing. Yeah.
A couple of weeks ago, we noticed our system was slowing down quite a bit, and mm-hmm. we came to the conclusion that one of our neighbors was getting some free internet access. So I changed the WEP encryption to a WPA.
Good.
We were using an Airport Express to extend the range to pick up a couple, and I hate to use this kind of language on radio, a couple of Windows machines in the back room. And
it works fine, though, doesn't it?
It does, but I'm wondering, since I changed the encryption, do I need to reset the Express? The Airport Express.
Well, in fact, it's no longer doing anything. That's right. It's just sitting out there.
I turned on one of the Windows machines for the first time in about 2 months the other day, and I was getting nothing. So I said, okay, I'm probably going to have to reset this.
You don't have to reset it. You just have to reconfigure it. So you'll have to do that from a Mac, and you'll use the Airport Administration Utility.
Okay.
And you'll go in there, and you just do basically what you did initially to set up the WDS. You have to set it up again.
Okay. Do I do a hard reset on the on the Express? Just plug it in.
Just leave it the way it is. Yeah, you'll do it all in software. Now, I have to say, I have done this many times. I'm always playing. You know me. I'm always playing with this stuff. And occasionally, I've found it useful to do a reset. It's very easy. There's a little reset button on there, and you just press it, and you hold it for 5 or 10 seconds. And that Express goes back to its original factory state. It'll be called Airport 53C721. And then at that point, you're still going to go into the Airport Administration Utility and reconfigure it.
Uh-huh.
You don't need to, though. I mean, all you have to really do is just go back in there. You're configuring your airport base station, and then you go to the last button, the WDS button, and you say, I want to add a unit, and it'll say, you mean this unit? And you say yes, and you go through that, and that's all you need to do. You don't need to reset it. Yeah.
A second question sort of based on the same thing.
By the way, good to use WPA in general.
Yeah.
Since your hardware supports it.
Much more secure. It's a little bit more of a pain in the behind, but that's okay.
Well, in the long run, it's easier because unlike WEP, which is implemented differently on Windows and Macs, and you have these long hex strings you got to paste in, it's a simple password on all platforms, and that makes it a little bit easier.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But we have noticed that we are picking up when I look at my airport pull down on the menu.
Yes.
On the toolbar up here.
Yes. Yeah.
We've got several other networks around us.
Oh, yeah.
And we sometimes see a slowdown when all of those people are online.
Is that because
we're all using the same cable system? Is that probably it?
Could be that. It could be that you're doing a little hunting, that your airport is doing a little hunting. Or not your airport, your computers are seeing other things and maybe trying to join those networks. If it's a significant slowdown, it may be that. One way to avoid that is change channels.
Okay.
I have a neighbor. In fact, I have to go knock on his door. Who's using a technology that I really hate.
And it's fortunately being phased out by these new MIMO routers. But for a while, you could get a router that was a double-speed router. And the way it did it was by eating a bunch of channels and, in effect, knocking neighbors off.
Ah, that's what's going on. Because my wife has had some problems with that on her her iMac. She will get knocked off occasionally.
Yep. I think that's probably what it is. I mean, it's a hard thing to do because what you're saying to them is, dude, you got a really rude router and you need to get a new one. And that's not, you know, that's expensive and it's not an easy thing to do. So I don't know how, it depends how good your relationships are with your neighbors. Fortunately, I like my neighbor and he likes me and I'm hoping I can, but even then I'm nervous about this conversation. But they sold them briefly. I don't think they're selling them anymore because the MIMOs, in fact, are faster and work better. In fact, maybe that's what I'll do is go buy a MIMO router for
them. I was just thinking of that. You know,
it's worth $50 to me to solve this problem. Say, hey, you know, I noticed you had this old router. Can I give you a new one, please? This was a terrible technology, and it was well known for knocking people off. It was very rude. The way they increased their speed is by eliminating other people. However, these new MIMO routers don't have that problem. Multiple in, multiple out. They're very sophisticated and they work very well. So, there's as far as I know, there's no way you could protect yourself because we're all on using this unregulated 2.4 gigahertz bandwidth.
Uh-huh.
And it's just there's no protection for you. In fact, I remember going to the FCC about a year and a half ago, 2 years ago now, and I asked them, well, you know, is there anything you can do about it? And they said, no. If somebody decides to put up a baby monitor on that bandwidth that sprays frequencies all over, it's kind of unregulated. You're kind of out of luck. So we just have to kind of be good neighbors, I guess.
Yeah, maybe I'll take him a new one.
Say, hey, how are ya? I would first find out what kind he has, and I'm going to try to remember the name of these routers. A lot of companies made them. I think Linksys made them. And they were a special kind of high-speed, you know, double your bandwidth router, and we warned people against them when they came out. It was a really bad idea. Fortunately, it's superseded now. I can't guarantee you that's what it is, but I wouldn't be surprised. That's very common.
It sounds like the symptoms, so we kind of have to assume that's where we're going until we find out something different.
Oh, I'm sorry, Henry.
Well, it's just the way it goes.
They say good fences make good neighbors, but what do you do when there's data? You need a data fence. Wouldn't it be nice?
Right.
I would love to have some way I could just block out all the RF coming from my neighbor, and then I wouldn't have to worry about this.
Uh-huh.
But we share the same airspace, and I don't know how you can stop it. Okay?
Thanks very much. Appreciate it.
My pleasure, Henry. Have a great day. Take care. Let's go to the 405 freeway where Charisse is driving very carefully, cell phone propped up against her ear. Hi, Charisse.
Hi.
Thank you for being so patient. I just noticed you were on the highway. I would have taken you sooner. What can I do?
It's okay. Actually, I've reached my destination.
often that happens. No longer on the 405. Where can I do for you?
I just purchased a Mac Mini.
Yay.
And I still have my good old trusty G4 Cube.
Right.
And I want to use...
You're just like me, Charisse. I've got my Cube and I got my Mini.
Really? Oh, you must
I replaced
know how to
my Cube.
This. I bet you have my answer. I got a wireless mouse and a wireless keyboard for the first time.
Bluetooth? You got the Bluetooth one?
Yes.
Yes.
And I got a cool 20-inch monitor, you know, the silver one.
Yeah.
And so I'm trying to use all of that with two computers, just one mouse,
right.
One keyboard.
Right. You need what's called a KVM switch, but it's a little bit more complicated because, unfortunately... Unlike the Mini, the Cube uses this weird Apple ADC connector.
Okay.
And you need to get a special adapter for it that turns the ADC into DVI. Now, the good news is you're going in the right direction.
Okay.
You're going from ADC to DVI, and that's a smaller, less expensive adapter. If you're going from DVI to ADC, it's a $100 adapter. It's very expensive.
Okay.
So what you're going to do is get a KVM switch, which stands for keyboard... video monitor. It allows you to share one keyboard, one monitor, one mouse with multiple computers.
Okay.
IO Gear makes them for Macs, so IO Gear doesn't
have
Macs.
See, I got that one, and it didn't.
Yeah.
It doesn't work.
Well, it's a little tricky, because as I said, you're going to have to get one that supports DVI.
Right. So the one I got.
Because you, You got a DVI monitor, right? You got a and iogear makes a DVI one, so you need.
Oh, they do. Okay, yeah. I got. I don't know why. You know, I called Apple and they told me one to get.
Well, maybe you can use it. Is it? Does it have DVI ports on the back?
No, it doesn't.
Oh well,
that's why I was like.
You know why they told you that? Because in the box with the Mini, you have this DVI to VGA connector. But I wouldn't use it that way.
Yeah.
Oh, you can't use it that way. You've got a DVI monitor. What am I thinking?
Right.
And you want that nice DVI monitor. You want that digital monitor.
I do.
So take it back. They make DVI. They're a little more expensive, mostly because the cables are more expensive. But I use an iogear DVI KVM switcher. It works great. You will also have to get an ADC to DVI adapter for the cube.
Okay.
And now the Bluetooth, I think you're going to have to get a USB mouse and keyboard. I don't know of. Well, there's another way you could do this.
Okay.
I don't know how well this will work on the cube because it's a slow computer. There's a software program called Synergy, S-Y-N-E-R-G-Y. Uh-huh. It's absolutely free. And what Synergy does is it's kind of like a virtual KVM. This actually is a setup that I use. Are your two computers networked together? I mean, are they on the same network?
They are. Yes, they will be.
Okay. You put the Synergy preference pane on both systems, and it allows you to use one mouse and keyboard on one system to control both computers.
Okay.
So what you'll do is you'll use the KVM only for the video.
Okay.
You'll put this free software on there. You'll switch video. And you won't have to switch the mouse or the keyboard because they just will work on both. And it's kind of weird. The way it works is I move my mouse off to the side of the screen and suddenly it's on a different screen. And then I can switch the screen over. And what's nice about that is you can now cut and paste between the two, which is really slick. So I can that actually is handy because then you can copy data from one computer and paste it into the other.
Okay.
Synergy. So you need the Synergy software, which is free, works on Windows, Mac, and Linux, by the way, and that's how I use it. And then you need a DVI-compatible KVM switch.
Okay. Those two things, and the adapter, and then I'm set.
And the adapter. And you have to be networked for the Synergy to work.
Okay.
All right.
I think I can work that out. Oh, thank you.
All right,
Cherise. I appreciate it.
Thank you. I'm glad you held on. I appreciate it. Take care.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Leah LaPointe, the tech guy, KFI, AM 640, more stimulating talk radio.
Matt Drudge, tomorrow night, 7 to 10 p.m., KFI, AM 640, more stimulating talk radio.
Leah LaPointe, the tech guy, on KFI, AM 640, more stimulating talk radio. Had a fun call, that last call with Cherise. And I don't think I've ever described this situation that I've got set up here. And I thought I maybe would mention this because it's pretty cool. Synergy is a neat little program. It's kind of the idea behind it is it's a virtual KVM. Now, one way you might use it is if you had two screens. That's how I use it. I have two screens, one for the PC and one for the Mac. And the two are networked together, but I only have one keyboard and mouse. The screens are side by side. When I move my mouse, the Mac screen's on the left. Let me see if you can visualize this. The Mac screen's on the left, the PC screen's on the right, side by side. Synergy's running on both. When I move my mouse to the right-hand side of the Mac screen, it just slides right over onto the PC screen. And there it is. And so wherever the mouse is, the pointer is, that's where the keyboard, anything I type now is going to happen on the PC screen. It's very robust. I use it all the time and it moves, and then I can move it back to the Mac. The biggest advantage of doing it this way, besides the fact that it's absolutely free, it's just software, is I can select some text, for instance, on the Mac, Command C to copy it, move my mouse over to the PC, select a window to paste it into, and then I control V, I paste it in, and the text is moved over from the Mac. So that's a very slick way of kind of working together. This works cross-platform. So we could have Linux PC, PC to PC, Mac to Mac, Mac to Linux. It doesn't care. It's an amazing little piece of software. So that's if you do a search for Synergy, S-Y-N-E-R-G-Y, and KVM, I think would probably be a good search term. You'll find it at synergy2.sourceforge.net. And open source and absolutely free. Very interesting idea. Now, if you want to only have one monitor, then you would use a KVM. And you could switch back and forth. I do use a KVM, but mostly because some of the time I have two monitors on my desk, and sometimes I want both monitors to be attached to the Mac. So I can switch it over to that, and then they're both attached to the Mac. So I have a dual screen setup. Most of the time, like now, when I want a Windows screen and a PC screen up, or a Mac screen up, I'll have them both individual. So that's a second switch. And then I have a third. If you have third or fourth PC, you can also control that. And that's the idea of a KVM, is one keyboard, one mouse, one monitor controls all of those. I kind of hit on this by accident, this kind of use of both Synergy and a KVM, and I've been very happy. It's actually, it really is a good little workflow. I just thought I'd share that with you. I don't know why. It's cool. It's geeky, but it's cool. All right, we're going to, I don't know. Show notes are online, KFIAM640.com. That's the website, the new KFI website. Really nice, by the way. You might want to check it out. There's all sorts of great stuff on there. KFIAM640.com. And if you want to go to my show notes page, what you do is you hover your mouse over the shows entry, menu entry there on that bar. All the hosts' names will pop down. Mine's Leo Laporte. You click that. That takes you to my special page with that fabulous picture of me. And right underneath the picture of me, there's three links. And you want to click the official website link. And that'll take you to leo.am. That's the show note page. This is show 250, believe it or not, for Saturday, May 27th. So you go to show 250 just by clicking the Saturday link. And I'll have notes in there. And then there's a comment box at the bottom if you'd like to add more to what we're talking about. Easy enough to do. Just go to the show notes page and you can, you know, make your comments and so forth. Or find links to Synergy and things like that. We're to take a break for news. We'll be back with lots more. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, KFI, AM 640. More stimulating talk radio.
KFI Weekends, the stimulating talk you want, and the Southern California news you need.
KFI AM 640.
Leo Laporte, the tech guy on KFI AM 640. More stimulating talk radio, taking your calls, talking the tech. Blake is in Massachusetts. MASSACHUSETTS. Hello, Blake.
Hey there, Leo.
How are you today?
Great. How are you?
You know how I know how to spell Massachusetts? It was on my son's spelling test this week. He had the New England states. So I've learned how to spell. What can I do for you today?
I'm having trouble recording into my Logitech USB mic through Logic Express.
Oh, wow. You're using Logic, huh? Are you making an album? What are you doing?
It's just a podcast that I'm doing.
Oh, cool. Okay. So you have to tell Logic where to get the audio from.
I'm using a Mac Mini, and it says that there's no audio driver.
Ah, you know, some Logitech headsets sometimes have trouble on Macintosh, although I use them. Which Logitech headset are you using?
It's a standalone mic, actually. It's an AK5370.
Is it a USB mic, or you have an interface for it?
It's a USB mic.
Oh, I didn't know Logitech made a standalone USB mic. Does the site say that it's Mac compatible?
Oh, yeah, because I can use it on other applications like Skype.
Oh, okay. So it is working on the Mac. It's only in Logic that it's not working.
Yeah.
But I thought you said the Mac didn't see it.
No, the Mac sees it. It's just I can't find where to put in to record in Logic.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm not sure because I don't have Logic sitting in front of me, but I'm... So what you did is you went to the system preference pane, you went to the sound preference pane, and you said for input, you selected the Logitech mic, right?
Yes.
you've already done that. Because otherwise, well, actually, that's not true. Because Skype lets you select it individually. So make sure you do that first so that the default input is correctly set in the Mac. It may be, and this is sometimes the case on some high-end, you're using a very high-end program to record. How come you don't use GarageBand or something like that?
Oh, I don't have iLife yet.
Ah, you happen to have Logic, but not iLife. Because that's a really easy way to do this. So you need, there is a program on the Mac you may need to play with called Audio MIDI Setup. I'm thinking maybe Logic, being a pro app like it does not pay attention to the standard preference pane, but in fact looks at the Audio MIDI Setup. Have you been in Audio MIDI Setup? That's in the Applications folder.
No, I've never tried that before.
Okay, yeah, that's kind of, most people don't know about it. It allows you to modify audio devices for MIDI applications, and I suspect that's what's going on. So what you want to do is open Audio MIDI Setup and make sure that in your audio input settings, you've selected the right device, which will be your Logitech mic. And it may be that Logic, I don't know, because I'll be honest with you, I have Logic, I haven't played with it that much. It may be that Logic doesn't even have its own settings. It just looks at the Audio MIDI Setup. So set it up there, see if that works. Otherwise, most audio programs have a preference or an option for setting what the audio input and output is. And the reason is these pro programs are for professional musicians who probably aren't using the standard audio on the Mac. They're probably using, you know, an M-Audio interface or, you know, a fancy interface of some kind instead of using, the standard Mac sound card. Okay. Give it a try.
Okay,
like, what? Tell me about your podcast. What is a podcast about?
Well, we're not really ready to do it yet, but I'm doing it with somebody on one of my forums.
Cool. Are you a student?
Yes.
What grade are you in?
I'm in seventh grade.
That's great. I just love hearing these stories of kids who are doing their own medium. What's the what's your website? What's the forums?
Well, it's not up right yet. Can I say the forums, though?
Yeah, yeah.
It's macteens.com.
Oh, I know macteens. I think that sounds familiar. Have we met?
No, I haven't gone into any conferences.
All right. I thought maybe I'd met you at the podcast expo or something like that. Okay, so Mac, is it macteens.com or macteens.net?
.com.
Well, it's a magazine. MacTeens Magazine. Well, that's cool. So you have forums there, and you'd like to do a podcast for this. Sounds like. And is MacTeens aimed at any general Mac users or teenagers who are using Macs to create content, or just any Mac user?
It's just basically Mac users. But the podcast is not for MacTeens. It's separate.
Oh, it's a separate thing. Okay, very cool. Well, keep up the good work. This is a nice site. Sounds like you're having some fun. Yeah, I think you could just play with it. You got to get the settings right. If you can use it for Skype, by the way, he just was using it for Skype, I realized. You should be able to use it. That shouldn't be a problem. It should be workable for a Logic. How could Skype be smarter than Logic? Brian, Manhattan Beach, welcome. KFI, Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hi, Brian.
How are you? I'm great. How are you? I'm very well.
Doing great. Hey, I got a question for you. I got an old system. It's a Windows 98 second edition.
Mm-hmm.
And we put in the restore disk. It's basically a computer router. And we put in the restore disk. And every time we try to reboot it and start it up, it goes to a little window that says, enter network password, username default, and then it wants me to put in some kind of password. And it won't complete doing the setup until I do this.
In Windows 98?
Yeah.
That's weird. And you hit escape and it still doesn't go. It requires a password.
I can get rid of it and then it'll finish the application and go right to setting it up.
Right.
But then it's like you can't just turn the computer on and walk away and come back and set up. You have to do it.
Oh, I see. You don't like it that it's pausing and waiting for you to do something.
Yeah, I mean, it's like we can turn it on, then we have to come back, then I have to hit close the window out, and then it'll take another, you know what I mean, 3 or 4 minutes to...
See, that's odd, because in XP, I'd understand that, because if you were running as a limited user in XP, you'd have to enter in an administrator password to install something, perhaps.
Uh-huh.
Although it doesn't usually do that. I wish it did. But it's odd that in 98, you are administrator. There's no such concept as a limited user in 98. You have full access no matter who you are.
Right.
So why is it asking you for passwords? Tell me a little bit more about this. You've logged into the system. You're using it.
I just turned on the system right now. And yeah. Then when it's going to set up.
Oh, I see.
A little window pops up. It says, enter network password. Enter your network password for Microsoft's networking, and then it says username, default, password.
Yes. Got it. I get what you're saying. Oh, you're taking me back now. The good old days of 98. So, yeah, you can disable the log. Basically, that's the standard login password in Windows 98. And the process was, unfortunately, was a little bit arcane, but I can walk you through it if you want.
Oh, I'd love it.
And what I'll probably do is also put a link in the show notes, because it's, you know, but essentially, if you have a blank password, this is the thing you got to get conceptually. If you have a blank password, it won't ask you for it. So you're bypassing it by hitting escape. But what you really want to do is just have a blank password. So the first thing to do is you have to go into the network control. Boy, this brings me back. I used to answer this question all the time about 10 years ago. You go into the network control panel, and you want to make sure that you have the Windows login selected. Right now, you have probably some network login selected as your standard network.
Okay.
So open the control panel, network, go to the primary network login, and it should say Windows login. That's step one.
Okay, you know what I did is I left the screen where it was, so now I'm sitting in that little...
You have to actually be logged in. So just, you have to be in the system. Yeah,
there I am. Okay, so now I go into...
Control panel, the network control panel, and select Windows login.
Where do you find network control panel?
Okay, start.
I am.
Under the start menu in the control panels.
It says programs, favorites, document settings. Programs?
Settings. Then control panel. Are you new to Windows?
No, I'm just a bad computer person.
It is kind of buried. So it's under settings, then there's a control panel folder, and in there there's a network control panel.
Okay.
See
network
it?
Network control panel. Well, it's got a little hourglass, but...
Yeah, Well, we don't have time to walk
you
through this.
Time. Okay, so here we go. Network control panel, and then what do I do?
Now, select the Windows login.
Window login.
Or sometimes it says family login.
Okay, or family login. Okay.
Do you see it?
No, I'm not there. I'm just going to do
it. Oh, you're still on the hourglass. So check the Windows login. And then what you want to do is you want to make that password be, create a new, if you have to, create a new user with a blank password. And that's the real key. Once you've got a blank password, if you're on the Windows login, you may not have to do this, by the way. Once you change it to Windows login, it may just do it automatically. But once you've got the Windows login, if you have a blank password, it's not going to ask you for that again. Okay.
And so then you're just saying, type in nothing.
Nothing. Just type in a name, create a new user, type in a name, and no password.
Oh, there it is. It says primary network login. Just get rid of that completely.
What was it before?
It says client for Microsoft Network.
Yeah, you don't want that. That's the problem right there. Just change that to Windows login. That may fix it by itself. But if it doesn't, you've got to have a blank password now.
Okay.
I'll tell you what. I have a long article on this. From computerhope.com. I'm going to put a link in the show notes to it. But I think that's, you know, now you understand the process. And the main thing was you had the client for Windows Network. That was the network selection. And that's what you didn't want. You're not on a network. You don't need that. That's for corporate networking. Thanks for the call. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. My pleasure. KFI, AM 6. I hate passwords. AM 640, more stimulating talk radio.
KFI News, powered by the worldwide resources of Fox News. KFI, AM 640.
KFI AM 640, more stimulating talk radio. I am Leo Laporte, the tech guy on KFI. We're taking your calls. We're talking high tech. Carl in North Carolina, welcome. I think you're going to be the last caller of the day. Hello, Carl.
Hi, how are you?
I'm great.
I've got probably a pretty silly question.
Okay.
Okay. I have a large external hard drive.
Yes.
Which I back up all my documents onto.
Yeah.
I have two computers, two XP computers. Now, what I've been doing is in unplugging the external hard drive, it's a USB connection, from one computer and connecting it to the other one.
Yeah.
What I would like to know, is there an AB switch for USB?
There is.
Ah! There is.
Absolutely. Sure. Belkin makes them, and a lot of companies make them, about 30, 40 bucks.
I couldn't find any place.
Well.
What do they call it?
They call it a USB switch.
USB switch? I've been looking under USB
switch, and it's exactly what you want. It's just like the old printer switches. You go from one to the other. It allows you to use USB, multiple computers with the same USB devices.
Right. Oh, that is tremendous. Okay.
Belkin, B-E-L-K-I-N. If you go to Belkin and you do a search for USB switch, they make a good one. A lot of companies make these. It's very simple.
Okay, and you recommend the Belkin, huh?
I like Belkin.
Okay.
I'm a Belkin guy.
Okay.
Yeah. All right, Carl.
And thank you very much.
Oh, hey, it's my pleasure. I'm glad you called.
Bye.
I appreciate it. And I appreciate your being here. Now, this show has been pre-recorded for your listening pleasure, but I'll be back tomorrow, 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. to take more of your calls and to talk more high tech with you on KFI. I hope you're having a great Memorial Day weekend. I'm glad you could be here. And remember, of course, the show notes are online at KFIAM640.com. You just click my name, Leo Laporte, over there on the left under shows. Yeah, it's not, you know, you have to hover over shows and it will drop down. It's a drop down menu and you click my name and that'll take you to my page. And right under my smiling face there on the right, you can see official website. That'll take you to leo.am. Now, we've got a comment box at the bottom of the page. And I do hope if you have a suggestion for any of our callers or some better ideas or even just some comments, you're welcome to put them in there. And I appreciate you for doing for that. Just to enter it and that's all you need to do. You can use a pseudonym or use your real name. That's fine. And what else do I need to tell you? Oh, yeah. My website is twit.tv. If you want to hear the podcasts or buy one of my books, they're all online. And, of course, on the website for KFI, we have podcasts of this show along with all the other KFI shows. So. You can listen live or you can listen at your convenience. I thank you for being here. Dr. Dean Adel is coming up next. Then it's John and Ken with a fresh program from 3 to 5. I am Leo Laporte, the tech guy on KFI AM 640. More stimulating talk radio.
May 27, 2006.
Well, that's it for this edition of The Tech Guy on KFI. Thanks so much for listening. If you're ever in the Southern California area, I hope you'll listen live on the radio every Saturday and Sunday from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. on KFI AM 640. You can also listen on the internet anytime at KFIAM640.com. Archives of older shows are available online on my website. That's leo.am. Click the audio archives button. And of course, you can subscribe to the podcast, which is leo.am/podcasts/KFI. My thanks to Howard Bailey for providing the theme music for this show. You can listen to Howard's music at soundclick.com. Thanks to DSL Extreme for providing the bandwidth. Of course, first of all, thanks to you for listening. I'll see you next time on KFI.